Welcome to Asia Pacific Defense Reporter, your go-to source for cutting-edge security insights in the region. Get ready for rapid-fire analysis and commentary from the Asia Pacific with your host, Kim Bergman.
Hello and welcome back. It's been a busy few days with the government releasing both the National Defense Strategy and the Integrated Investment Plan last Wednesday. And I've just realized that these podcasts are going to be very useful for future psychiatrists to trace my decline into madness. And that process has been aided by these two documents, their contents, but especially the reporting of them, which in large measure has just repeated the government's talking points about a $50 billion increase in defence funding over the next decade. Now, there are many parts of that that I'll get to, but I'll just point out that the next 4 years, in particular, will only see $4 billion, a billion and a bit per year, which in reality is actually only adjusting for inflation. We just don't get anything in particular for that spend. Now, it could be that Defence Minister Richard Marles actually believes this. He certainly sounds convinced, and I'll say that ministers, actually all politicians, they're a mixed bunch. Some of them understand very thoroughly how government works. Others do not. They're just not that interested in mechanisms. For example, it's very clear that even some cabinet ministers do not understand how the judiciary works. In other words, we have checks and balances. Hypothetically, a party gaining an absolute majority, that is, in both the House and the Senate, could pass a law decriminalizing murder. Now, that would obviously be appealed by the usual do-gooder lefty tree-hugger types, and it would be found to be invalid because of about 4,000 years of legal precedent that shows that killing other people is never a good idea, unless you're at war with them. It's on that basis that possibly Minister Marles genuinely does not know how the budget is managed, and the reality is that governments can only spend money that they have in the current financial year. Basically, you cannot write a cheque for 2035. You can only have funds released one financial year at a time. Now, funding in the IIP is in two categories, approved and unapproved. Approved means, yes, the department can definitely go ahead and spend it. Unapproved means, for planning purposes only, you can assume that you will get it. That's quite a reasonable approach, by the way, because circumstances change. It's just impractical to have too much spending locked in too far in advance. This summary actually has been confirmed by one of Australia's best defence analysts, well, particularly with the budget, Marcus Hellyer, ex-defence and ex-Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And he probably knows more about how the defence budget works than anyone does. Anyway, most of the money in the unapproved category leaves open the possibility that a future government or even a future minister might have other priorities. And Marcus also does a decent karaoke number, which I can describe in detail if there's sufficient listener interest, on a future occasion. Now, there's no legislation for this funding increase, and even if there were, that could be overturned in future or simply ignored. So this money, it's all aspirational. And I feel it's a shame that it isn't reported as such. And the reason why I'm suspicious about this and some other sort of professional skeptics is, of course, because so much of the proposed increase is in the future rather than immediate. It's going to occur in the term of another government. And also, for a funding increase to be genuine, it should be an increase after inflation. As I've actually written in the most recent edition of the magazine, if defence spending goes up by 3% and inflation is running at 3%, then the actual effect is no increase in capability because, obviously, the numbers cancel each other out. But back to the speech of Minister Marles at the National Press Club on Wednesday. Before I get to my own question to him, I have to highlight part of the speech reflecting a level of stupidity even I had not anticipated, but it's there in black and white. And remember, what I'm about to quote is not an answer to a question under pressure. This is in the speech. You can find the transcript on the ministerial website, drafted by the greatest minds in the Department of Defense. And it says, this is the quote, "In the government's response to the Defense Strategic Review last year, we announced the reduction in the number of new infantry fighting vehicles from 450 to 129. This was on the basis that there was no capacity to ever move 450 infantry fighting vehicles off our shores. This meant they would never contribute to Australia's ability to project. This is just one example of the decisions we have been prepared to take." My goodness. This is the quality of thinking in our department and from our minister. A Canberra-class LHD can only carry about 50 IFEs, and we only have two of them. So what's the point of having more than 100 of these things? Because they can never be deployed in greater numbers than that. Now, everyone sit down, pour yourselves a stiff drink, because I am about to make a stunning revelation, and I risk being arrested and charged for conveying information of such enormous strategic importance, and it is this. Ships can go out and come back. The LHDs could deliver one load of infantry fighting vehicles, come back and pick up another load and deliver it. Now, that's how invasions work. Ships go backwards and forwards. It might take two or even three round trips, but 450 infantry fighting vehicles can be deployed without any problems. Now, that might mean unacceptable delays if, for example, we were invading Norway or Iceland, but for this region, that's fine because any major conflict will go on for months, if not years. Now, incidentally, each of the Canberra-class LHDs can carry about 1,000 soldiers, so by the same logic of Minister Miles, that should limit the army to 2,000 soldiers, which would certainly help with the current recruitment crisis, and that term crisis, by the way, was used by the minister during his speech. I'm coming up to another need to scream session, and once again, I am doubting my own sanity, because with IFVs, there's another way of getting them into combat, apart from by ship, namely C-17 transport aircraft. The RAAF has seven of these highly capable machines, and let's say two are in maintenance at any one time, that's still five, that can be shuttling backwards and forwards, delivering one 45-ton redback infantry fighting vehicles at a time. But given that it takes time to load and unload them, you can still move quite a lot of material fairly quickly. Now, defence plans for scenarios, and again, this isn't, seriously now, this isn't a secret, I'm not revealing anything in confidence, but they prepare for scenarios such as a military coup in our region, for example, Fiji, where there were a lot of Australians on the ground, they might get caught up in this, we would want to get them out, and then possibly also become involved in some sort of peacekeeping mission or whatever. Now, the first thing that you would do, we'll use Fiji as an example, you'd seize a couple of airfields and then start delivering troops and infantry fighting vehicles. IFEs coming in by C-17 and the troops arriving by the much more numerous C-130Js. And Ukraine, by the way, the fighting that's happening there is actually showing that infantry fighting vehicles are much more useful than main battle tanks. The main battle tanks are just too heavy, bridges collapse, they sink into the ground, all of that sort of stuff. Now, Fiji is 3.5 hours flying time from Brisbane. It takes time to load and unload a C-17, so you wouldn't do more than two sorties a day, but that's still 10 redbacks being delivered every 24 hours. And one or two LHDs would then start to deliver the really heavy stuff, a lot of equipment, even more infantry fighting vehicles a couple of weeks later. So there's just no logical justification whatsoever reducing that number of infantry fighting vehicles from 450 to 129, or certainly not when it comes to their deployability. And the same people who have come up with this nonsense are exactly the same people telling us things like we need nuclear-powered submarines. Anyway, this is a side issue, but I'm highlighting it just so that everyone can see how pitiful is the level of thinking within defence and sometime from the ministers responsible for the portfolio. Now, the question that I was originally going to put to the minister was about Taipan helicopters, and anyone who thinks that issue has gone away has another thing coming. Now, my question was going to be, in this year's defence budget papers, at page 129, 129, it says, and this is another direct quote, defence will commence drawdown and end of service arrangements for MRH-90 Taipan. A transition facility has been established at Townsville Airport to store aircraft in preparation for end of service. Minister, with that in mind, why did you go against the directive in your own budget paper and instead have the entire fleet scrapped and buried? Anyway, that was the question that I didn't get to ask, but maybe next time. And that was because when I was skim reading the integrated investment plan, I noticed a figure that really jumped out at me. And this is about nuclear powered submarines. And so the question that I did ask was, I refer to the $13 billion that you have committed over the next decade for nuclear-powered submarines. Now, if I understand, a full one-third of that $4.7 billion is the impending transfer to the US submarine building industry. Can you explain how that figure was calculated? And is it a coincidence that that's almost exactly the same amount that you've now committed to giving to the UK submarine building industry base? And if you want, you can watch this online or read the full transcript or whatever. But the answer was pretty much waffle. At least it was confirming these huge numbers being handed over to the US and the UK. But he went on to say, and this has also been a favourite talking point of Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy, when he said, let's be clear, the vast bulk of the money that we're going to invest in industry is right here in Australia. Okay. Let's think about that, or let's think about the detail of that for the moment. And what we do know is, this has been announced by the government, well, announced several times, is a $7 billion expansion of HMAS Stirling in Western Australia. And that's purely so that nuclear-powered submarines from the UK and the US can be docked and had work done on them. And another $2 billion at Osborne in Adelaide to prepare the way for the future construction of the AUKUS submarine, if that ever arrives. So that's a total of $9 billion in WA and South Australia, purely for pouring a lot of concrete and building some houses. That's it. It's just infrastructure stuff. There's no value add there. There's nothing high tech. There's nothing that is contributing to Australian defence industry. I mean, it's great news if you drive a concrete truck, but that's really about as far as it goes. Now, add that to the $4.7 billion being handed over to the US. The first tranche of that, about $3 billion, I believe, is due in October. Lump all of that together, and of the $13 billion of approved funding for nuclear-powered submarines, we're already at $13.7 billion. So anyway, to do this job, remembering that I work for an absolute tyrant, one has to keep one's humour, and at least this massive investment in infrastructure to me, it seems a little bit cargo cultish. And for those listeners who are not anthropologists, the cargo cult was a sort of Melanesian quasi-religion that emerged, well, gathered strength, I should say, after the Second World War. And it came about because people with no education at all and no contact with the outside world had seen cargo planes arriving and delivering huge quantities of stuff, this food and machines and all of the rest of it. So people started imitating this by building fake runways with fake control towers and imitation aircraft, all made from bamboo and leaves, in the hope that this would cause real aircraft to deliver to them unimaginable quantities of wealth. Never happened, of course. Just seems to me that here in Australia, we are building the infrastructure in the hope that the submarines will eventually be delivered. And on that front, because I really do strive for truthfulness and honesty, I must record an important development in the United States, namely that $3 billion of additional funding has passed Congress heading for the US submarine building industry base. I made a big deal about it being blocked a few months ago, so now I have to record that it has passed. But it doesn't lessen the main point that I was making about US politics and the myth in Australia, propagated by the government and repeated by the media, is that somehow bipartisan support in Congress guarantees AUKUS. Not so fast. Because of the US presidential system, it is that person who makes a number of critical appointments, including, for our purposes, the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Navy. Now, under a Trump presidency, we don't know who they would be, but it might be the disgraced ex-General Michael Flynn or Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz or some other Russia-friendly person. Now, what happens then? These America First types won't be interested in anything coming to Australia. They regard us as a bunch of commies because we have things like gun laws and Medicare. So, again, please, all that I ask for in the reporting of these matters and the public discourse of these matters is recognition of reality of the situation that we're in. As I keep on saying, we might get nuclear-powered submarines, but equally, we might not. Now, in the same bundle of legislation, there was money for Israel and $60 billion worth of military equipment for Ukraine. That's 95 billion Australian, which must come as a huge relief in Kiev because the country, as we've been reporting, is really under serious threat. And because everyone is distracted by what's going on in Gaza, this just doesn't seem to be sinking in. Despite the situation on the ground in Ukraine and despite the US moving, this government, and Richard Marles in particular, were completely unmoved. And when one of my colleagues, Andrew Green from the ABC, asked about the situation with Ukraine, he just repeated the normal platitudes that Australia is supporting the country and mentioned $50 million that we've recently contributed. I mean, $50 million is, you know, it's something, but really, it's pathetic in the overall scheme of things and means that Australia remains at about 38th on the list of donor countries. And I just don't get it. Why not give things like RBS-70 missile systems, very effective ground-to-air anti-aircraft, anti-drone, anti-helicopter systems? Ukraine desperately needs more air defense. They already operate RBS-70s. We have plenty of them, and we don't want them anymore. It should be a no-brainer. Now, the government talks about supporting a rules-based international order, but when it comes to Ukraine, it looks as if it is only going through the motions. And look, no wonder the polls are neck and neck between Labour and the coalition. But in the national security domain, the coalition has a huge lead of between 15 and 20% being more credible. And the government might seriously want to reflect on that. Despite all of the claims about AUKUS and all of the noise about defence funding and impactful projection and all of that rhetoric, their reputation is going down the toilet. Maybe, just maybe, that's because many people can actually figure out that most of what we're hearing is empty rhetoric. Anyway, I have run out of time. Thank you for listening, and see you next time. Bye for now.
That's today's Asia Pacific Defence Reporter. For more in-depth articles, expert opinions, and exclusive interviews, visit asiapacificdefencereporter.com. Stay informed, stay ahead. This is your source for all things defence. Until next time.